The Gospel according to John, chapter 15 and the first 17 verses. And in approaching this great chapter, it is important to keep the wide context of this great address in view, lest we get bogged down in incidental details. The immediate subject of our passage is undoubtedly fruitfulness in believers. The fruitfulness of believers. But there is no doubt that the removal of the branches from the vine mentioned in verse 2 and reference to it again later on, verse 6, is connected with Judas's departure and ultimate destruction, so that the theme of the passage must include potential unbelievers. Nor is it unusual in the New Testament for the spiritual health of believers to be related to the possibility of falling away in apostasy and being lost like Judas. This is the great problem, you remember, in Hebrews chapter 6, verses 4 to 8, which speaks of the impossibility of recovery after falling away, having been enlightened. So that spiritual health and spiritual life are closely connected in the theme and the passage. That doesn't make the teacher's task any easier. For while the subject is the fruitfulness of the vine, by the branches abiding within it, there is always in the background the possibility that the lack of fruitfulness is due to lack of life. I watch somewhat anxiously some new plants in the garden to see whether they have taken root or not. The first sign that they have not taken root being no growth. The second being a withering of what is there. And the trouble here in John 15 is somewhat different from that. Whether the unfruitful branches ever really belonged to the vine or were of some parasitic growth. So that the test of abiding in the vine may affect both believers, as far as fruitfulness is concerned, and false professors also, as far as their departure from Christ is concerned, and their destruction. Someone asked the other Sunday, what Peter meant by exhorting believers to make their calling and election sure. Ought we not to be sure? Yes, of course. But our assurance lies only in our continuance. And that is an ongoing thing. Even Jesus said, he who endures to the end shall be saved. However, this challenge to abide in the vine ought not to affect our assurance and our peace and our present enjoyment of the Lord. But these blessings cannot possibly be separated from the reality of our continuance. Doesn't that stand to reason? Surely. This is the only proof that we have. God knows more. This is the only proof that we have that a soul is a believer, that he continues in the way. Now, some have read the taking away of branches in verse 2 as merely lifting them up to help growth. And the word iro in the original can bear that meaning. But the context of verse 6 is against it. The cutting off of unfruitful branches is quite different from the pruning of fruitful branches. But both are dealt with here. And since Jesus goes on from talk of pruning to talk of cleansing in verse 3, it is clear that he is speaking of those who belong, but also of such as Judas who did not belong. You remember that in chapter 13 at the feet washing, Jesus said, the disciples were clean, but not all, which was an undoubted reference to Judas. That there is this darker side is all the more certain when we think of the number of references to Israel as the vine in the Old Testament, and practically all the references to Israel as the vine in the Old Testament are adverse. For the truth is, the historical truth is, that God's Israel was a tragic disappointment to Almighty God, their God, Yahweh Jehovah, most of the time. And that he might have any hope of her, even after the great shunting match of Romans chapters 9 to 11. You know what I mean, of substituting the church for Israel throughout the gospel ages. That he might have had any hope of her is such a surprise that you could understand certain interpreters. I believe Dr. Lloyd-Jones partook of this at one time, thinking the nation of Israel was finished with and a spent force as far as God's purposes for her were concerned. But you would never get the Apostle Paul to agree with that. See Romans 11 verses 12 to 15 and 25. Nor would you get the Lord Jesus to believe that he was finished with his natural people Israel. For our blessed Lord was determined that his national people would yet fulfill their remit. I commend to you some passages that I'm going to read, and you can turn them up if you choose, or listen while I read them. The first one is in the 80th Psalm and the 8th verse. Psalm 80 and 8. The psalmist says, "You brought a vine out of Egypt. You drove out the nations and planted it. You cleared the ground for it, and it took root and filled the land. The mountains were covered with its shade, the mighty cedars with its branches. It sent out its boughs to the sea, its shoots as far as the river." The sea is the Mediterranean, and the river is the Euphrates. "Why have you broken down its walls, so that all who pass by pick its grapes? Boars from the forest ravage it, and the creatures of the field feed on it. Return to us, O God Almighty. Look down from heaven and see. Watch over this vine the root of your right hand has planted, the sun you have raised up for yourself. Your vine is cut down. It is burned with fire. At your rebuke, your people perish." Then the famous passage about the vine in Isaiah chapter 5, the first 7 verses. Isaiah chapter 5 at the beginning. "I will sing for the one I love a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it up and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it and cut out a wine press as well. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes, but it yielded only bad fruit. Now, you dwellers in Jerusalem, and men of Judea, judge between me and my vineyard. What more could have been done for my vineyard than I have done for it? When I looked for good grapes, why did it yield only bad? Now I will tell you what I am going to do to my vineyard. I will take away its hedge, and it will be destroyed. I will break down its wall, and it will be trampled. I will make it a wasteland, neither pruned nor cultivated, and briars and thorns will grow there. I will command the clouds not to rain on it. The vineyard of the Lord Almighty is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are the garden of his delight. And he looked for justice, but saw bloodshed, for righteousness, but he heard cries of distress." Jeremiah chapter 2, verse 21. Jeremiah 2, 20 indeed. Jeremiah 2 and 20. "Long ago you broke off your yoke and tore off your bonds. You said, 'I will not serve you.' Indeed, on every high hill and under every spreading tree, you lay down as a prostitute. I had planted you like a choice vine of sound and reliable stock. How then did you turn against me into a corrupt, wild vine?" Ezekiel chapter 15 and the first 8 verses. Ezekiel 15 and 1. "The word of the Lord came to me, 'Son of man, how is the wood of a vine better than that of a branch on any of the trees in the forest? Is wood ever taken from it to make anything useful? Do they make pegs from it to hang things on? And after it is thrown on the fire as fuel, and the fire burns both ends and chars the middle, is it then useful for anything? If it was not useful for anything when it was whole, how much less can it be made into something useful when the fire has burned it and it is charred? Therefore, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. As I have given the wood of the vine among the trees of the forest as fuel for the fire, so will I treat the people living in Jerusalem. I will set my face against them. Although they have come out of the fire will yet consume them. And when I set my face against them, you will know that I am the Lord. I will make the land desolate because they have been unfaithful, declares the Sovereign Lord. And Ezekiel chapter 19 and verse 10. Ezekiel 19 and 10, your mother was like a vine in your vineyard planted by the water. It was fruitful and full of branches because of abundant water. Its branches were strong, fit for a ruler's scepter. It towered high above the thick foliage, conspicuous for its height and for its many branches. But it was uprooted in fury and thrown to the ground. The east wind made it shrivel. It was stripped of its fruit. Its strong branches withered and fire consumed them. Now it is planted in the desert, in a dry and thirsty land. Fire spread from one of its main branches and consumed its fruit. No strong branch is left on it fit for a ruler's scepter. And lastly, Hosea 10 and 1. Hosea, the prophecy of Hosea, 10th chapter, 1st verse. Israel was a spreading vine. He brought forth fruit for himself. As his fruit increased, he built more altars. As his land prospered, he adorned his sacred stones. Their heart is deceitful, and now they must bear their guilt. The Lord will demolish their altars and destroy their sacred stones. But, of course, there is the true vine in the Old Testament, although the word vine at Isaiah 11 and 1, the word vine is not mentioned. Isaiah 11 and 1. A shoot will come up from the stump of Jesse. From his roots a branch will bear fruit. The Spirit of the Lord will rest on him, the Spirit of wisdom and of understanding, the Spirit of counsel and power, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord, and he will delight in the fear of the Lord. He will not judge by what he sees with his eyes, or decide by what he hears with his ears, but with righteousness he will judge the needy. With justice he will give decisions for the poor of the earth. He will strike the earth with the rod of his mouth, with the breath of his lips. He will slay the wicked. We will therefore leave now the notion of apostasy, for it can never apply to God's true Israel, Old Testament or New Testament, that is, Israel national or Israel Evangelical, I mean the church. Let's leave the thought of apostasy and possible apostasy in order to consider the branches pronounced clean by his saving word. You remember what Paul said about this to the Ephesians. He said, Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, to present her to himself a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. Therefore, since Christ is the true vine, we must abide in him, both for life and for fruitfulness. To survive and endure to the end and be saved, but also to be fruitful on the earth. As to fruitfulness, then, there are these stages, aren't there, in the passage, if we can call them that. There is the stage of bearing fruit, then of producing more fruit, and then producing much fruit. And these progressions depend upon two things vitally connected. The first is abiding in the vine, and therefore becoming fruitful, as Jesus promises, and therefore suffering pruning, so as to bear more fruit and much fruit. And these two things are vitally connected, fruitfulness and pruning. Now you see, we need to get beyond the figure of the vine, fascinating as it is, well, as it is to anyone who knows anything about the culture of the vine, viticulture as it is called, the fruitful, this is the point, the fruitful is to be pruned. Well, most people know about the necessity of pruning roses to produce good roses. I have more than once spoken here of a rose bush. I don't remember if it is still growing in a garden at Queen's Cross, but it's been growing there most of my years living in that area. And at first it was a gorgeous rose bush. But somehow or other, the rest of the garden was always tended. That rose bush was never pruned. And so it grew and grew and grew, and the roses, the rose blooms, grew smaller and smaller and smaller until they become wild roses. And beyond that stage, there wasn't a bloom to be seen at all. You see? But why is the fruitful to be pruned, you might ask? Well, surely, to ensure a continuance of blossom and fruit, because of the danger of rampant growth without blossom and fruit. I have a plumbago plant in my staircase, if you know what that plant is. It's quite rare in this country, although it grows wild in the tropics. And this plant bore lots of beautiful pale blue flowers last year. But I failed to prune the plant last year after it flowered, and while its growth is rampant this year, it has only borne two poor blooms thus far. Practically nothing like our Lord's fig tree. Nothing but leaves. The lesson is obvious, isn't it? The Lord cannot trust any of us with too much fruitfulness. We become taken up with fruitfulness and become increasingly eager for more and more fruit, forgetting that as plants need rest, humans need rest also, spiritually as well as physically. And if they don't get it, they thereafter begin to produce nothing but leaves. The Lord has always to introduce a spell of cross-bearing to ensure that we continue to be fruitful. Whether there be in one's life rhythms of that or not, it is true. Have you noticed that in your life or in the life of others, that there must be spells of cross-bearing? Of course you have, because that is when you and I begin to jib, and we regard those hurts and knocks and frustrations and painful episodes in our lives, often very wrongly, as reverses. And they're not necessarily. We say, why does God allow this and that and the other? And you know, the answer is often plainer than we want to see. For the why, you see, that rises so readily in our complaining hearts, why? The why is actually silenced and answered by the fact that it is fruitful servants who are pruned. And the only way you can get round that is by deliberately ceasing to be fruitful. If you have been fruitful and give up disgruntled. And to do that is so perverse that God may have something excessively painful to say to you if you try it, as some have tried it. Here then is a principle which concerns those whom the Lord is using. At certain stages, you will need, and I will need, to be pruned. And what might that pruning involve? I wondered, you know, if the fact that the matter of prayer requests was raised at verse 7. You see? I wondered if that might have anything to do with my question. What might that pruning involve? What do I mean? A life of active fruitfulness could lead, and often does lead, to a life of prayerlessness. Ask some of these world-famous evangelists if they are not frequently tempted to neglect prayer and the necessity to pray, and to forget the vital connection between the hidden and the evident. Great many Christians have no idea at all of the vital connection. Like the underwater cables for radio and television that used to pass between this country and America. Hidden by the ocean, but there. Great many Christians have no idea, and there are Christians here, I'm sure, have no idea of the connection between the hidden. The prayer closet and the powerhouse and the evident. And talking of the evident, I might talk not only of things spiritual, but of things material and even financial. But no more of that. Do you see the connection? Do we need to be driven back from fruits to roots? I think we do. And not just to prayer as making requests, the kind of thing which once almost swamped our prayer meeting until we had to call a halt to what was virtually a proliferation. This was the prayer meeting largely, a proliferation of shopping list prayers in order that we might learn anew as we have begun to learn in recent years. How to worship the Lord in prayer before we ask a thing. But you see, it is a fact, even in a meeting convened for prayer, it is a fact that fewer engage in the worship sections in the earlier part of the meeting than in the intercessory sessions. I suppose because the worship session may test how near we are to the Lord or how far from Him personally. With the danger, you see, of turning our dear Lord, the Lord of glory, into a kind of tradesman to whom we have practically nothing to say beyond making our requests at the counter and getting what we want. And then, goodbye, Mr. Shopkeeper. You are a handy man to have around when I need you. That hardly indicates close fellowship and friendship, does it? The people we send for when we need them? Is that all the Lord is to us? It is a matter of love. As Jesus goes on to say at verse 9, for you see, there is an almost unwritten rule in our prayer meeting that during our worship session of prayer, following the ministry of the word, which is generally a psalm and has been a psalm for years, we've gone through the Psalter a number of times in the course of the years, following the ministry of the word, we engage in a session of worship when no requests are to be made, only prayer of pure worship of God in adoration and thanksgiving and praise. And this tests our love for Him. a love which at that wonderful 11th verse of our chapter expands into joy. I have told you this so that my joy may be in you and that your joy, notice, my joy becomes your joy, may be full. You see. And then at verse 12, the expansion from personal joy to a concern for others. My command is this: love each other as I have loved you. So you see, this is what fruit bearing is. Now be careful here. Fruit bearing. It is not necessarily soul winning. Wonderful and wise as that is, as Daniel and the preacher in Proverbs says, he that winneth souls is wise. But you see, as I've indicated a moment ago, there is a danger even in that activity of soul winning. As with the evangelist of an earlier day, the fly leaves of whose Bibles were covered with the names of his converts. He had turned his successes into statistics. But the question is, with regard to fruit, the first fruit is character. And how far abiding in God, we love him. And because we love him, we find our joy in him, and therefore learn to love others. Not to clock up, not to clock them up as trophies, but as souls loved for Christ's sake and loved with his love. The statistics are kept in heaven, safer there. Ah, but it is costly to live like this and involves much pruning. Greater love has no man than this, than that a man lay down his life for his friends. That's what Jesus did for his friends. That's sacrificial love, the fruit of which, as he says at verse 16, will last. I recall that my reason for turning away from a life of music, and I wasn't despising it, and I don't despise it now, was that I wanted to do something with my life that would last into eternity. It's a dying love, by which is meant that something in us has to die to produce it. Is that not what Jesus says in that famous verse in John 12:24? Except a corn of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it abides alone. But if it dies, it will produce many seeds. As to abiding in him, we were talking last Sunday about the interpenetrating actuality of love. And I said that the perfect natural illustration of that was union in marriage, but that that was too private to expound in public. But we can easily talk of it in terms of friendship, because the best marriages are those in which friendship is the essence, so that the friendship continues to blossom even if passionate desire begins to diminish or fail altogether. You know, to hear a man, after well over 30 years of marriage, say with his arm round his wife's shoulders, "It gets better every day," is something, isn't it? And it ought to be like that with our marriage to the Lord. Could you live without the Lord? Could you? Is your private thought life not a haven in which you continually, into which you continually run to commune with Him? So that two things happen together, that you both luxuriate and rest in the Lord, and yet sometimes you together think furiously about all sorts of things and about people. It's restful, always restful, and yet always exciting at the same time. Life would be empty without that inner, secret, holy chamber in which we commune with the Lord alone. A marriage beyond human marriage. You know, when we see someone exceedingly attractive and kindly, it may be on a TV screen, we may think, "I would like to talk to him, or I would like to be with her. I think they would have so much to say that I would want to hear from their knowledge and understanding of life." I myself often think that Lord Denning would be a lovely man to know. Challenging, yes, old man though he is, yes, but so kindly and human. I think the Queen is that sort of person, perhaps even more so than her mother. They say the Queen is lovely to talk to, very modest and respectful of others. But we have Jesus all the time, the master of the universe, the source of all wisdom, and he's on call 24 hours a day. Wake in the night and he's there, not asleep. He slumbers not, nor sleeps. And it's great to have such a counselor. It fills my soul more and more with thought and the marvel that I'm able to have daily counsel from the Lord about things great and small. The maker and governor of the universe is, in a sense, dare I say this, Lord? Is it my beck and call? Lord, what am I going to do about this, about that? Why, you see, I'm almost singing our last hymn already, because it falls to my lips so naturally. I wonder if it does to yours. Let me read a bit of it. I've found a friend, oh, such a friend, he loved me ere I knew him. And that's a profound thing to say. He drew me with the cords of love, and thus he bound me to him, and round my heart still closely twined those ties which naught can sever, for I am his and he is mine forever and forever. I found a friend, oh, such a friend. He bled, he died to save me, and not alone the gift of life, but his own self. That's tremendous, he gave me. Naught that I have, mine own I call, I'll hold it for the giver. My heart, my strength, my life, my all are his, and his forever. I found a friend, oh, such a friend, all power to him is given. Well, that's a statement, isn't it? To guard me on my onward course and bring me safe to heaven. The eternal glories gleam afar to nerve my faint endeavor. So now to watch, to work, to war. Aye, but, poet, you don't need to wait for heaven to rest. That will be perfect rest. To watch, to work, to war, to rest, and then to rest perfectly. In heaven, I would put it that way. I found a friend, oh, such a friend, so, this light, so kind and true and tender, so wise a counselor. Oh, what this means, what this means, to have the Lord as counselor and guide, so mighty a defender against all the powers of ill. From him who loves me now so well, what power my soul shall sever? Shall life or death, shall earth or hell? No, I am his forever. And we'll sing it with our hearts. Hymn number 705. 705.